Okay, where are we in this in the course so far? We're trying to get at these very basic issues of how international conflict is to be understood. Are there general principles that should guide foreign policy? Not directly, not by analyzing them on a purely abstract theoretical level, but by looking at these various historical interpretations that the kind of main theoretical approaches have a certain affinity with, to a certain extent, translate into, that serve to support them. And we're looking at the whole problem of the failure of the peace after 1919. What went wrong in the interwar period? Right? And there's a standard view that was associated with the liberal approach to international politics that things were pretty rough in the immediate post-war period. The European allies, especially the French, were much too willing to resort to force, to practice the kind of old diplomacy, too obsessed irrationally with the German threat. And it was because the French insisted on policy of strict enforcement of the treaty, crushing Germany, keeping Germany down, that in the initial post-war period that there was such great instability. The period from the signing of the Treaty of Versailles in June 1919 through the occupation of the Ruhr, which basically lasted in its acute form as a crisis to the end of 1923. And then, according to this interpretation, things sorted themselves out. The Europeans were able to kind of stabilize their economic relationships, put their currencies on a sound basis instead of the hyperinflation of the early 1920s they had in Germany and other countries in Central Europe. You had monetary stability, you had economic prosperity, Germany was a democracy, Britain and France were democracies. They were able to work things out. The great symbol of this is the Treaty of Locarno of October 1925. This was basically a treaty between Germany and the Western powers. It seemed that these former enemies were burying the hatchet and determined to bring on a new era of peace. Right? And everything seemed to be okay in the late 1920s. You know, this was an era when people hoped that they had put the passions of the war behind them, that they would be able to go look forward to a relatively bright future where the threat of a new war was essentially, minimal. And everything was going great. Again, this is according to this theory. Until a depression struck at the very end of the decade. And the depression caused all this political instability, ultimately leading them, bringing the Nazis to power in Germany. And it was only when the Nazis took power in Germany that things really started to go downhill. That in this view is a very sharp dividing line between the 1920s and the 1930s, between prosperity of the late 1920s, the depression of the 1930s, between the German democracy of the 1920s and the Nazi dictatorship of the 1930s. Very sharp line of demarcation there, right? And with the notion that if there hadn't been a depression, everything would have been okay. If there hadn't been a depression, the whole Locarno period with all of its hopes, that would have been borne out by, a true reconciliation between Germany and her former enemies, and everyone basically being willing to live with things as they were. Everyone thought not in terms of their narrow national interests and gaining power over their adversaries, but rather in terms of building Europe, forming a common civilization, to be sure, with a certain anti-Bolshevik, anti-communist edge because the Bolshevik revolution energized that sense in the middle classes especially that European civilization was under siege from these barbarians in the East, and they had to kind of pull together to kind of defend themselves against the communist threat. The Bolshevik Revolution had that sense, but the idea was that insofar as it had any great political importance, it was to pull Germany and the Western powers together, pull Western Europe together, right? That's that view. And against that view, there's a different interpretation that we associate with the realist view of international politics, which is that dividing line between the 20s and the 30s, not nearly as sharp as people made out. Yeah, Germany was a democracy, but that didn't mean that the Germans had, turned their backs on their old political aspirations, that they no longer thought in political terms, that they were willing to accept the essence of the Versailles system, where German power was limited. And the notion is the Germans naturally would want to build up whatever military force was needed to provide for their own security, that there were kind of these core political issues that were common to the 20s and 30s. This whole problem of what is the basic structure of power in Europe going to be? Is Germany going to be kept down indefinitely? Or are you going to do away with the Versailles constraints, which meant that Germany would once again become the strongest power in Europe, stronger relatively than she had been even in 1914 for the reasons that I discussed, right? And that prosperity or depression, democracy or non-democratic regimes, according to this realist view, you're going to have these problems. And so this whole notion that people had at the time that Europe had turned the corner, that they had left the white water and had entered into the blue seas of perpetual peace, and that a lot of these things that were done during the Locarno period, like famous Kellogg-Briand Pact, outlawing war as an instrument of national policy, all this, all those things that were taken so seriously at the time, the realists say it's an illusion. It's it's a mirage. You're taken in by things that are going on the surface, and you're not paying nearly enough attention to these structural problems, these kind of core political problems, which necessarily dominate international politics. Right? Two interpretations. It follows from that. And if you want to kind of get some insight into the kind of core theoretical issue here, liberalism versus realism, how is international politics to be understood? What are the main forces driving things? Regime type or the structure of power? If you want to get some insight into those kind of core theoretical issues, you want to analyze the historical questions very closely. Who's right? Which interpretation of the interwar period is correct? And in particular, which interpretation of the Locarno period, the second half of the 1920s, is correct? Okay? That's the basic framework. Right? Begin by kind of just reviewing part of the story from the 1920s. Was it the case, as the Wilsonians argued at the time, and as you still find in a lot of the textbooks, that the French were out to kind of crush Germany, that the French, were totally uninterested in building a stable new European order, that they were militaristic, and that this was just poisoning the peace of Europe, whereas the Americans and the British had a much more sensible approach to these issues. That approach to the to understanding the history of the interwar period, you see, it has a real moral edge, a judgmental edge. You know, Americans are good, the French are bad. As opposed to the kind of political view, which takes more jaded, it's like very hard to make these moral judgments to say the French were wrong, you know, not willing to kind of write off the fruits of their victory, in that they should have just sat on their hands while Germany walked away from the Treaty of Versailles and allowed Germany to build up her power, because the fundamental difference in resources was such that once, Versailles was no longer operative, German power would once again dominate France, more so than in 1914, because there's no counterweight to German power in the East anymore. A political view. Real estate, those political considerations were fundamental for them. You can't really blame the French. But on the other hand, you can't really blame the Germans either. You know, obviously, every country would want to control its own destiny. The Germans, they're not going to want to be kept down forever. It's natural for them to resist. But if it's natural both for the French to try and maintain some shreds of their victory, and the Germans to want to kind of, you know, achieve a position in world affairs that's commensurate with Germany's inherent power, you can't be too judgmental about these things, but instead you have to focus on that political conflict. You know, where there are no rights and wrongs, but both sides have to be concerned with considerations about power, about the structure of power in Europe. Okay? And we saw when we looked at French and German policy in the immediate post-Versailles period that instead of a headlong rush toward overthrowing using military force against Germany, and as soon as Germany didn't comply with the treaty in any minor way at all, you know, would be use force against Germany, send the troops into Germany, you know, just put the knife to Germany's throat. That was not French policy at all in the post-1919 period. They wanted very much to work things out, especially this issue that was the focus of international tension, the reparation question. Why are the reparations important? Because economic considerations are important? No. The reparations were important because they were the most vulnerable part of the Versailles system, the part that was easiest for the Germans to resist, where they had the most sympathy abroad for resisting, hardest technically to enforce. So naturally they're going to focus on this rather than on areas where it would have been obvious that they could have complied with the treaty if they had wanted to, like disarmament. It's the structure of power in Europe that's at stake. It's the whole Versailles system that's at stake. Whose power is going to dominate Europe? And instead of the French kind of just going in, you know, with military force in the event of any non-compliance of the Germans with the treaty, you find a much more moderate French policy. They actually use the term about economic collaboration with the Germans. Part of this was the idea that maybe the continental West Europeans should come together and form a counterweight to the Anglo-Saxons, as the French called the British and the Americans. This is a policy which is going to become very important in the post-World War II period, but you see the French already playing with these ideas after World War I, even during the Paris Peace Conference, but especially in 1920, 1921. I told you about the Seydoux plan. But as part of this general notion that the solution is economic collaboration. We don't want to keep Germany down forever. We want to reach some sort of accommodation with the Germans. Exactly on what terms is kind of unclear. And part of this has a very important economic component. I've said a number of times in this class that steel production is the heart of the modern industrial economy in Europe during this period. Extremely important militarily, because military technology is based on the production of steel. Steel production in Western Europe is concentrated in this area where France and Germany meet. What do you need to produce steel? You need two things. You need iron ore, and you need a coal, but not just any coal, the kind of coal that can be turned into metallurgical coke. France has other kinds of coal, but in order to produce steel, the French need German coking coal, which is produced in the Ruhr Basin here, just off the Rhine River in western Germany. And the basic iron ore deposits are in Lorraine, you know, both the part of Lorraine that had belonged to Germany before the war and the part that never left France. Right? This is called Minette iron ore. Not the best grade of iron ore for the production of steel, but since the development of the Thomas process for the production of steel in 1879. The Minette iron ore could be married with the German coking coal from the Ruhr, and you produce steel. As a matter of fact, as the steel production process became more efficient and you needed less and less coal to produce a given ton of steel, there was a gradual shift in the center of gravity of the German steel-producing industry prior to World War I toward Lorraine, which is then mostly in German hands. Right. So you have this coal and steel and iron kind of complex in this area where Germany and France met. And the French notion is, let's integrate all of this stuff, and then France should have a certain participation in these German coal mines, German heavy industry. There was a natural complementarity between French iron ore and German coal. They should kind of get together because the French needed the coal, but on the other hand, if they got the coal and it fed their blast furnaces and they were able to produce all the steel, and steel which traditionally a lot of it had gone to the regular part of Germany, they also needed markets. It made sense to kind of bring all this stuff together. They wanted to work out a business-like relationship that would enable them to do so because they wanted to maintain this heavy industrial base that had grown up in Lorraine during the German occupation period after 1871. Okay? They wanted this because they had the sense of themselves as relatively weak in economic terms. They wanted a collaboration with the Germans, but for the same sort of reason the Germans resisted. In purely economic terms, France needed Germany a lot more than Germany needed France. The Germans didn't have to rely on this low-grade Minette iron ore to produce steel because they can import higher quality iron ore, like from Sweden, or use scrap iron to feed their blast furnaces. These German heavy industrialists were averse to making a deal with the French on French terms. And one of them said, when all this stuff was coming to a head, he said, you know, let them choke on their Minette. We don't need their Minette iron ore, right? The whole French problem is that, yeah, France has this momentary military advantage. For the time being, Germany is disarmed. The Rhineland is occupied. There are French troops, you know, in the Rhineland, even on the right bank of the Rhine. Can you build your policy on that kind of temporary advantage? You say, well, maybe not. Maybe we shouldn't put all our eggs in that basket. Nothing, you know, there's a famous saying from Napoleon, he said, nothing permanent is based on pure force. You know, you need a certain sense of legitimacy, consent, to build a permanent political system. France is thinking in terms of her long-term security needs, she has to think in terms of good relations with Britain and America. Will they come to France's aid if Germany at some point in the future throws off the Versailles constraints, builds up her power, and again threatens France? And so the French have to be concerned about British and American attitudes. and British and American attitudes shifted very dramatically in the winter of 1919-1920. It's just astonishing. It's like, well, what happened? All this kind of vengefulness, they would call it this belief in the importance of justice, that was the keynote of British and American policy through the peace conference. It did not sit well with another element, especially of American thought, which was that the use of force, the use of military power, is not a normal, not a natural, not a legitimate element of international political life. It shouldn't be used in peacetime. It's only to be used when the moral issues become absolutely clear-cut. And then it should be used without limit. Right? Wilson squared the circle at Paris by saying that, the Germans, in their hearts, they're going to know that we're right. They're going to accept this verdict. They're going to then buckle down and be subjected to what Wilson called a generation of thoughtfulness, undergo this 20-year period of penance and making up for their crimes, and then we'd welcome them back into the community of civilized nations. But for the time being, you had to keep them down. You couldn't give them equal political rights, right? So you had that on the one hand, but on the other hand, you had this aversion to the use of military force. Well, when it became clear that the Germans were not in their hearts going to accept the Versailles verdict and were going to resist the treaty, and then the question of force was then presented front and center. You know, are you going to let the Versailles constraints go down the tubes, or are you going to enforce them? Well, you can't. And so they made the choice. They said, well, you don't want force to be a normal part of international political life. You don't want the peace to be based on the knife constantly being held to Germany's throat. You want it to kind of move away from those notions of justice, in quotes, to a peace based on reconciliation, where we put the passions of the war behind us, where we try and mend fences with the Germans, bury the hatchet, you know, reach some sort of understanding with them, you know, rule out the use of force, and instead reach for reconciliation. All right, so you have that basic change, and it was intensified by an important development that took place in the economic area. As you all know, the First World War was financed by inflationary means. You know, all of these governments expanded their the monetary supply to pay for the war, and that's why the war was even before the United States went into the war. This policy was practiced. That was why the wartime period is a period of such great prosperity. It was an inflation-based boom. But there was a sense in those days that was not permanent, and that we had to return to sound money, and that the old exchange rates had to be reestablished. And what this meant was that the monetary authorities in Britain and America just slammed on the brakes, you know, and had a dramatic policy of deflation, which caused a depression in 1921 that was as sharp as the Great Depression of the 1930s in terms of magnitude. The duration was a lot less, however. Okay? So you had a huge unemployment in Britain and America as a result of this particular monetary policy that was pursued. But these governments aren't going to take political responsibility for the high levels of unemployment that had resulted from their policies. And it was much easier for them to say, oh, all of our problems are because Europe is such a mess. There's such economic instability in Europe. Why is there economic instability? It's because of all this reparations business, and this creates all these problems with the German inflation, and, you know, with the French and so on. We're against all of that stuff. So in intensified opposition in Britain and the United States, the use of force by France for British and American attitudes, the French are very sensitive to this stuff, and the Germans are also sensitive to it as well. Right? So you have the French, you know, reluctant to use force against Germany. You go through the remainder of 1919, the whole year of 1920, the French are reaching out to the Germans, the Seydoux Plan, you know, all this kind of stuff going on, the year 1921, the whole year 1922, until finally the French are faced with the core decision. Are they going to let the whole Versailles system go down the tubes and write off the reparations, or are they going to use force? So finally, January 1923, the French cross the threshold, Ruhr crisis, Ruhr occupation, 1923, the great climax of the dispute between France and Germany over reparations, really over the Versailles system. Climax of that whole story. Right? You say, well, why does Germany resist? I should say, before I finish with France, note that the French policy is to be understood in parapolitical terms, in terms of France's relative weakness vis-a-vis Germany, in terms of the permanent bases of national power. Right? Germany's a stronger country, a bigger country, in terms of population, especially in terms of industrial capacity. Germany had been spared the violence of the war, whereas northern France, the most heavily industrialized part of that country, had been devastated by the war. Right? Huge blood price that the French had paid. No longer a counterweight to German power in the East. France, sensing her own weakness, dependent on the British and the Americans, or kind of hostile to a policy of enforcing the treaty. France, it's bound to adjust to those geopolitical pressures. It's bound to sense what the true structure of power is and can't simply ignore that in the conduct of her policy. Power considerations, political considerations of that sort, fundamental importance. And what about on the German side? Again, German resistance has to be understood in those terms. Why do the Germans resist? Because they sense how weak France is. They sense that there's so much sympathy for them in Britain and America, hostility in Britain and America to the use of force against them. And so a policy of resistance makes sense to the Germans, right? So you have this situation where both sides, their policies are heavily influenced by geopolitical factors, by the sense for what the true structure of power is, what they can get away with in the long run. Yeah. All right. So everything comes to a head in 1923 with the Ruhr crisis, and we saw how the Ruhr crisis developed, and how basically the Germans threw in the towel in August of 1923, but the French simply refused to take yes for an answer, because the French had escalated their goals and were thinking in terms of, if we just hold fast and don't reach a deal with the Germans, Germany's going to fall apart. That's, a disintegration of the German Reich. That's what we want, right? But the French didn't pursue that policy to the bitter end, because faced with the prospect of mass starvation in Germany and probably a Bolshevik revolution in Germany, the French didn't want to, go that route. The whole idea of a massive communist bloc stretching from the Rhine to Vladivostok, how could the French, contemplate something like that? So the French are open to British and American mediation. The British and the Americans, they have the money. They're willing to help the French get back on their feet financially, economically, solve the whole reparation business. They're also willing to help the Germans get back on their feet, right? But the condition for this involvement, which culminated in what was called the Dawes Plan of 1924, was that the French agree that there's not going to be any more use of force against Germany, no more Ruhr occupations. And the French, that policy of the use of force was essentially bankrupt by 1924, rejected by the French people themselves, who elect now a left-wing government that comes to power in Paris. So you may say, well, that should be the end of the story. That should be the end of Versailles. Path is clear to the Germans. The French are not going to use force against them. What's to keep the Germans from building up their power? And here's where the story kind of gets very interesting, because it turns out that the system which basically had shackled France did not totally empower Germany. Why not? Because the hyperinflation, you know how extreme it was. People take these wheelbarrows full of paper marks down to the bakery just to buy a loaf of bread. You know, a trillion marks to the dollar. That's that sort of thing. Basically, everyone's savings had been wiped out, and just a lot of bitterness in Germany because of what had happened. You know, it's, to this day, the Germans are traumatized by the prospect of inflation. I don't know if you follow this stuff, but the European Central Bank just adopted this big program of monetary expansion. Germans are not happy about this. And a lot of those fears about inflation go back to their experience in the immediate post-World War I period, culminating in the hyperinflation of 1923. How does this affect things? Well, in late 1923, the Germans stabilized their currency. And then finally, they put their currency back on gold, and convertibility to gold, which meant essentially that the exchange rate between the German mark and the American dollar was fixed, right? But it was fixed at a level that allowed the Germans to live beyond their means. It was fixed at a level that meant that Germany was importing more than she exported. And how did she finance that surplus of imports over exports? By borrowing abroad. They borrowed a lot in especially in the New York money markets, which were now kind of open to them. And that influx of American capital essentially sustained the German exchange rate at an artificially high level, which made it possible for the Germans to import more than they exported. And they used this money to finance what was, for the day, a relatively advanced welfare state. A lot, you know, you go over to Germany today, you look in these small towns, and you say, "Well, where was the? When was the local swimming pool built?" Well, 1927. You know, the local sports arena, 1928. That sort of thing. So there's this flow of American capital into Germany, and the Germans were aware of the fact that this whole situation where the existing exchange rate of the mark against the dollar was supported and viable only because of the continuing flow of American capital into Germany, they were aware of the fact that if they acted too aggressively in the political sphere, that would threaten the flow of American capital into Germany. And then they would not be able to sustain the mark at its high exchange rate. And if the mark started to fall against the dollar, then there's this great fear of, oh, this is going to set off in a new inflationary spiral at home. No, we don't want that, given what we went through, right? So these considerations greatly inhibited German freedom of action as well as French freedom of action. Okay? Now, Does all this mean that both sides were now locked into a peace policy that neither side could use force, neither side could contemplate an aggressive policy? Not quite. What was German policy in this period from late 1923 to the end of the decade? Not full acceptance of the Versailles system, not even of the territorial system. Right? The Germans still wanted very much to throw off these constraints on their power, to build up their army to whatever level they felt was appropriate to provide for their own security. And then once their power was built up, then they would be able to talk in a much stronger voice and insist on territorial changes. And what were those territorial changes that they had in mind? Well, we know what they were, in large part thanks to the work of a German-American scholar named Hans Gotzke. Gotzke was a refugee from Nazi Germany in the 1930s as a young man, came to the United States. Not Jewish, by the way. He came simply because he hated the Nazis so much. After the war, he worked on an important archive that had fallen into the hands of the Western allies. These were the Stresemann papers. Gustav Stresemann was the leading figure in German foreign policy from late 1923 to 1929. And Gotzke kind of was very surprised at what he saw, given that the whole rhetoric of the day was Stresemann is a good European, Stresemann is a man of peace, he was the co-winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, and you know, it was a symbol of how things, you know, could have been put on a totally different basis. And what Gotzke found was that Stresemann, you know, it was like very upfront about what his strategy was. What's the strategy? Well, we talk in a soft voice now, but we gradually try and build up our military power. We tell the Western powers what they want to hear, and they're very willing to have the wool pulled over their eyes. Right? And then we'll build up our power. And then when we build up our power, then we could talk in stronger tones and insist on territorial changes, especially in the East. And what did he want? Well, obviously, to get back the Polish corridor and Upper Silesia, these areas of Germany had lost to Poland after the war. The city of Danzig, obviously. German city, why not? But not just that. The German-speaking areas of what had been the Austrian Empire, German Austria. And that wasn't even all there was to it. He even said, Alsace-Lorraine is not lost for all time. I remember one of my first papers in graduate school was a volume of German diplomatic documents from the post-Locarno period had just come out in 1926. And there was this very interesting debate in the German Foreign Office about these kind of core political issues. On the one hand, there were these kind of extremists focused on their ambassador in Moscow, Count Brockdorf Rantzau. And he basically said, we should join with Russia, and the two of us should rebel against the treaty, you know, head on. And then there was a group focused on their ambassador in London, named Hirsch, and he said, no, what we should, you know, the West is serious about burying the hatchet. We should not reject the outstretched hand. We should try and, you know, work with the British and the French and form a kind of West European bloc, a decent relationship with our former enemies. This is like, these are the people who are the predecessors of the Adenauer policy after World War II. And Stresemann and his top collaborator in the German Foreign Office, the State Secretary there, Karl von Schubert, they said, no, we don't want to go either of those two routes, neither the Eastern route nor the Western route, and instead we want a balance between East and West. There's this term in German, Schaukelpolitik, meaning kind of, you know, playing off the East versus the West. If the West doesn't give us what we want, we're going to threaten them that we're going to tilt more to the East. You know, and similarly with the Soviets, if they don't align themselves with us to the degree we want, we're going to threaten that we're going to align with the West. We can force them into a bidding war against each other for our political support. And in that way, we can gradually throw off these constraints, right? Eat away at these constraints, you know? And so in fact, you know, this policy had been pursued by the Germans to a certain extent before the Ruhr crisis. One of the things that inflamed the French was that the Germans were being very cozy with the Russians. They signed a very important treaty. Everyone should know this term, the Rapallo Treaty between Germany and Russia in 1922, you know, symbolizing that, you know, Germany and Russia were kind of coming together against the Western powers, right? Stresemann's feeling was, well, you always wanted to balance things. So the Locarno Treaties of 1925, they were balanced by the Treaty of Berlin between Germany and Russia in 1926. You wanted to maintain a free hand. You wanted both sides to feel that they had something to lose, and also conversely, something to gain by cultivating your goodwill. Something to lose by not doing what you wanted. And that way, you gradually throw off these constraints, and you would be able to build up your military power. And once your military power was built up, then you can insist on territorial changes, right? And it was quite clear later on what Stresemann was up to. I mean, Hitler himself, he said about Stresemann, of all my predecessors, he was not the worst. And Goska quotes this in her comments, faint praise perhaps, but still remarkable considering the source. All right. So in pursuing this policy, what does Stresemann do? The key thing here are the Locarno treaties. Okay? October 1925. Germans are open to this. It seemed to kind of symbolize a new era in relations between Germany and the Western powers. What did the Locarno treaties provide for? The main Locarno Treaty was called the Rhine Pact. This basically was designed to stabilize the status quo on Germany's western border. Okay. Neither Germany nor France would be able to attack each other, nor would Germany threaten the demilitarized status of the Rhineland, one of the key elements of the Treaty of Versailles. To be sure, Germany had accepted this in the Treaty of Versailles, but under duress. Now Germany was accepting it voluntarily, which meant something. Right? Not only did everyone agree to accept the status quo in the West, the borders plus the demilitarized status of the Rhineland, but that arrangement was guaranteed by two powers. Great Britain, by far the most important guarantor, but also fascist Italy. Mussolini had come to power in Italy in 1922. It seemed that this guarantee, reassured Germany against French aggression, also reassured France against possible German aggression. It seemed to be a source of stability, seemed to symbolize the dawning of a new era of peace. But there are other treaties agreed to at Locarno, treaties, arbitration treaties between Germany and her eastern neighbors, Poland and Czechoslovakia. The big difference between the Rhine Pact and these Eastern arbitration treaties. These Eastern treaties were not political. They simply focused on these kind of legal disputes. Didn't mean that Germany was accepting the status quo in the East. And the Germans, even in those days, took care to emphasize the difference between the Western settlement and the Eastern settlement. Okay? Okay. So people thought the Locarno treaties were ushering in a new era. Certainly the Germans wanted people to think that. But the two sides had very different notions of how things would develop. Everyone said Locarno was a beginning. The Western powers had this whole idea that Germany should kind of play a certain game. Germany should do all these things to show that she was no longer a revisionist power. She wanted very much to live at peace with her former enemies. And when the Germans had demonstrated through their behavior, their whole manner of conducting themselves, that they were good Europeans, they were willing to live with things as they were, basically, then the Western powers could gradually dismantle Versailles system and allow the Germans full equality in the military sphere. Okay? That's their notion. The Germans had a different notion. They said, we don't have to play that game. German people, this is. We're entitled to equality by right. We're no more responsible for the war than they are. So, and therefore, if they're serious about peace, they have to treat us as equals. And so all these things that they're giving us as part of the Locarno policy, these alleviations, we don't have to pay them for that because this is what we're entitled to. Right? So when the Allies withdrew from the first zone of occupation, the Rhineland, ahead of schedule, withdrew from the Rhineland, there were nationalist demonstrations in Germany. You know, the Allies were upset. You can't you get you know, the British told their ambassador, can't you get the Germans basically to play along? It's very much their interest not to turn us against them. And but the Germans had their policy of playing off East against West. As I said, they signed this Treaty of Berlin with the Soviets in 1926, putting pressure on the West. We're not in your camp. We still want to balance off between you and the East. They had a policy of secret rearmament, military collaboration between the German Reichswehr and the Red Army on Soviet soil where the Allies couldn't see. Allies understood what was going on, but they couldn't bring themselves to abandon the Locarno policy. Right? They couldn't bring themselves to revert to a policy of force which had supposedly been discredited in the early 1920s. So no matter what the Germans were doing, the cheating on the disarmament provisions, fully known to the Allies felt, we're locked into this policy. It's a great British statesman of the late 19th century, Lord Salisbury. He said, the commonest error in politics is sticking to the carcasses of a dead policy. And that's exactly what you have here. The policy is bankrupt. You know, this is known to the political leadership, the top political leadership in France and Britain. You know, they're not able to kind of truly reconcile the Germans. The more they give the more the Germans sense that the policy of force, the policy of resistance works, and therefore we should continue doing it, and we'll just keep shaking more and more out of the West. Right? But what's the West to do? They're locked into this policy, so without really hoping for too much, they continue giving these concessions to the Germans. 1927, the removal of military control from Germany. Okay? 1930, the evacuation well ahead of schedule of the Rhineland, the end of the Allied military occupation of the Rhineland. And then December of 1932, a month before Hitler comes to power in Germany, they grant Germany equality of rights in matters of armament. But Germany will be able to arm. Not that the Allies were going to do anything about it anyway, but you could see that they feel themselves trapped. Now, was this... You know, these changes, what did they have to do with the Depression and so on? The chronology is the key thing to note here. Okay. This whole problem is developing during the height of the Locarno period, well before the Depression struck. Okay. What's the proof? 1929, before the stock market crash in New York, before the Depression hits Europe. 1929, the French approved the construction of what was to be called the Maginot Line. Do I have that there? M-A-G-I-N-O-T, Maginot Line, okay? 1929. Remember that date. See, well, you know, understand why that date is so important. Maginot Line is a line of fortifications, defensive fortifications, in northern France, from the Swiss border to the Belgian border. And why would the French want to build a line of defensive fortifications if peace were solid? There, they sense that a German threat is emerging, right? Gradually emerging as Versailles, is being dismantled, as Germany is building up her power. They're already taking measures, defensive measures, to prepare for that emerging German threat. Now, all these things are very important in terms of the questions that we started out with. Greater continuity between the 20s and 30s than people said at the time. You know, power political considerations of greater importance than people thought at the time. You know, a fundamental political conflict between France and Germany not resolved. So much so that, I'll just leave you with this last quote, that a French journalist who was observing these things around 1930, he looked at the developing tensions between France and Germany, before Hitler came to power, this is. And he says, when friends quarrel, people say it's because of a misunderstanding. In reality, it's because a misunderstanding is being cleared up. And that's kind of what you had in the immediate pre-Hitler period. Okay, next time I'm going to talk about the Nazi Revolution and its consequences.